The title of tonight's talk, as I mentioned, is called Thoughts on Death and Dying. And I originally sort of laid out this talk a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago now, actually. And with the impetus for that at the time was within about a 6 week period that winter, I guess that'd be winter of 2022. Two of my old friends, people who were both around my age, a bit younger, maybe a year or two younger, both died within like 6 weeks of each other. One from COVID and one from cancer. And it was like, oh, I should better start thinking about death and dying a little bit more. And so that was like the original impetus. It was like it was on my mind, shall we say. And then, having just given a couple of talks about self, not self, over the last couple of weeks, this seemed like a natural extension of that series in a sense. It's like it seems natural to think about and talk about death and dying as part of the ideas around self and not self. And then, even more recently, like a few days ago, I turned 75, and I was thinking that both my grandfathers died in their early 70s, and this is like 60 years ago, and this is like considered totally normal. This is when old people, 70. Oh my God, they were so old. That's when they died. And now, luckily, because our health system has gotten better and there's been lots of discoveries on how to deal with things that they had that couldn't be dealt with 60 years ago. Life expectancy has got getting longer, but who knows? I mean, I really have this feeling all the time now that I have no idea whether I'll be here tomorrow. And I have to sort of live with that idea. And so that makes me think about this whole idea about death and dying as well. And then at supper tonight, as my wife was talking, and she said she'd seen this just recently, like today or yesterday, she saw this video of Jane Goodall, who had was celebrating her 90th birthday party, and she was like fit and walking down the beach, and there was all these dogs around, and it was like, and she was saying, and I thought this was really struck me, this was really interesting. She said, now that she's 90, she feels she has to work harder and do even more because she doesn't know how much longer she has. So she's trying to be as active as she can for as long as she can and do as much as she can. And she feels like she has to do more now than she did 30, 20 years ago. Oh, that's an interesting thought, too. So, anyhow, all of those thoughts are swirling around. And then I want to share what I thought about a couple of years ago and comment on that, and then add some more comments near the end of this talk about how this relates to not self as well. So this is this first thing I want to read is from this is called The Zen of Therapy by Mark Epstein, who is a well-known Dharma teacher, but he was also a well-known therapist, and he sort of combines therapy and Dharma in his practice and in his life. And this first note is the note I put here was called Speaking Openly About Death, which is something in our culture that people just don't do. Right? It's like, oh, well, we don't want to talk about that. Right? So we can talk about a lot of things, we don't want to talk about that. So that's, in some sense, I'm sort of saying, no, we should talk about this. This is something that Mark Epstein has to say. I mean, this is a little, essentially a little story he tells about this idea. A good friend of mine from high school had just died after a 3 year battle with cancer, and we were visiting his wife several days later to bring her some food. Her son and daughter-in-law and their 2.5-year-old son are also there. We bring them bread from the bakery near us, chopped liver and eggplant dip my wife had prepared, and a polenta and spinach casserole. This is very typically what people do, right? Someone passes and you sort of feed everybody. It's like part of the tradition in a sense. After sitting and talking and eating, I got up to wash the dishes. The son and daughter-in-law are in the kitchen with me, and to my surprise, ask if they can ask a professional question. What should we say to our son? They want to know. It has not occurred to me that their son would not yet know about his grandfather's death. I feel for their predicament. How are they to introduce death to their open, trusting, and loving child? He keeps asking, "Where's Grandpa?" they say. We told him he is away for a while. "You didn't tell him anything yet?" I inquire, stalling a bit, not yet knowing how to best say what I'm thinking. "How come?" "I didn't see the point of ruining his perfect life," the father said. "It's up to you how you want to deal with it," I begin, knowing in my heart that the boy's perfect life has already been disrupted. "But I think you should tell him the truth." How you phrase it depends on what you think, but it might say something like, "Grandpa died. His body couldn't be go on any longer, and he had to let it go and get ready for the next one." "I actually believe that," I continue, gathering steam. "So it would be natural for me to phrase it that way. But what you say is less important than acknowledging the fact. He's going to sense that something has happened. He will hear conversation about it, and there's a funeral coming. And if you don't explain it, he will make something up about what it that will be all the more confusing because you won't know what he is thinking. The worst thing would be that he feels your tension around it or your sadness at the loss and thinks it is because of something he did. Kids feel what's going on around them, but they can't understand, and they make up about it if they can't explain it. This is very hard for any of us to understand. It certainly will be difficult for him, but he will grow into it, and you can help him over the years. So this is like wise advice for not just kids. This is something we have to sort of be open and honest about with anyone. It's just something that's important. I want to share the several things the Buddha said, of course. This is I have several verses from the Samyutta Nikaya, oh, pardon me, the Majjhima Nikaya, the little pithy pieces here. And the first of these is, you might ask in general, broad terms, what's the cause of death? This is the Buddha's answer to what's the cause of death. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. With the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. The way leading to cessation of aging and death is just this Noble Eightfold Path. But what he's saying is the cause of death is birth. Oh, that's an interesting thought. It's like, this is in a facetious way. I remember someone saying once, but it struck me. It's like, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. It's like somehow we get this idea that we can avoid it or put it off or not think about it. Because it's not going to happen to me. But by the way, it is going to happen to you and me and everyone else. It's just that's the nature of the whole thing. It's another. So this is where the Buddha is talking about things that aren't worth thinking about, things that aren't worth trying to figure out. And this is a common theme in other suttas, but this particular sutta, he actually lists all the things that aren't worth figuring out. Among them, thoughts on death. But I thought I'd read the whole little verse here because it's like This is so, when you hear this, it's like, my God, that's like 95% of philosophy right there. So wipe all that stuff out. Okay. This is a, therefore, remember what I have left undeclared as undeclared, and remember what I have declared as declared. So he's saying, there's certain things I said, remember those. Everything else, I didn't talk about them, I didn't declare anything about them. Don't bother thinking about them because it's not worthwhile. And what have I left undeclared? The world's eternal. I've left undeclared. The world is not eternal. I've left undeclared. The world is infinite. I've left undeclared. The soul is the same as the body. I've left undeclared. The soul is one thing and the body another. I've left undeclared. After death, I exist. I've left undeclared. After death, I do not exist. I've left undeclared. After death, I both exist and don't exist. I've left undeclared. After death, I am neither exist nor does not exist. I've left undeclared. So thinking about what happens after death, he says, it's all being left undeclared. It's way more useful to pay attention to what's happening in your life right now, in this moment, than to speculate about what happens after death. Because the truth is, we don't know. I mean, there's lots of stories and ideas and theories and philosophical statements and religious statements. It's endless what's said about what happens after death, right? But we don't know. And it's way better off to not worry about it, not think about it, and just go on practicing, paying attention to what you can work with, which is what's going on right now in your life and what's arising in your life right now. Yes, here's another interesting one. This is also, he's talking about death. And here he's talking about sorrow and why sorrow arises. So this householder had, his son had just passed away, and he went to the Buddha to try and understand, right? Householder, your faculties are not those of one who is in control of his own mind. Your faculties are deranged. How could my faculties not be deranged, venerable sir? For my dear and beloved only son has died. Since he died, I have no desire to work or to eat. I keep going to the charnel ground and crying, my only son, where are you? My only son, where are you? So it is, householder. So it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear. Arise from those who are dear. Venerable sir, how would you ever think that sorrow, lamentation, pain, and grief, and despair are born from those who are dear? Arise from those who are dear. Venerable sir, happiness and joy are born from those who are dear. Arise from those who are dear. Then, displeased with the Blessed One's words, disapproving of him, the householder rose from his seat and left. And what the Buddha is pointing to here is that if you're in relationship with someone, whether it's a, an intimate relationship, or it's your child, or it's your parent, or it's your friend, or it's your sibling, whatever, if you have relationship with anyone that's of any significance at all, then inevitably, sorrow and lamentation are going to arise. It's built into the equation. It's like if you're close with someone, there's bound to be a time when either you pass away and your friend is going to be caught in sorrow and lamentation, like I was with my friend's passing a couple of years ago, or they're going to pass away and you're going to be full of sorrow and lamentation. This is natural. This is normal. There's nothing wrong with it at all. But it's something that we forget. And there's one solution is to be a hermit, or take sannyasa and become a monastic where there's no intimate relationship. But even there, monastics, because they're living together closely, and one of them dies, there's sorrow and lamentation there, even in the monastic community. I mean, it's not, it's like maybe less because it's less a less intimate relationship in some ways, but it's always going to be there. As soon as you're in relationship with people, this is part of life. I became very aware of this on one of my long retreats. This is a 6 weeks retreat I did at the Insight Meditation Society. This is several years ago now. And I got very sort of still and focused and concentrated. And it must have been 4 weeks in or something like that. So I was pretty steady at that point. And I started having these experiences. And I can't call them dreams or waking dreams or anything, or thoughts or imaginations. They were experiences of dying, of what it was would be like to die, in the sense of the scenario around it. And that would ha I had several of those, and then it switched, and I wasn't dying, but my wife was. And in both cases, guess what? Lots of sorrow and lamentation were going on. But what was interesting was if I was dying, it was like, well, that's okay. I mean, it was like, maybe I was a little bit upset about it, but it was like, I'm a good Buddhist, I understand I'm gonna die. And so I was like, okay, but my upset was because I could see how upset my wife was. And my wife would be upset because she was going to be left and I was going to be gone, and vice versa. When she was dying and I was the one who was left, she would be dying very calmly and I'd be going, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm going to, after 47 years, those sorts of thoughts that arise, right? Perfectly natural. But this is, it's part of the process of being in this world and having in being in relationship with others, that this is what's always going to happen, without exception. Without exception, we're all going to experience this. This is what, in some sense, this brings us together, because it's a universal experience. Without exception, there's always going to be in our lives sorrow and lamentation. It's just part of being alive, is that people around us are going to pass away. It just is. And we don't like to think about it, but that's the truth. And it's like we should know this, and which is why I'm talking about it, obviously, and why the Buddha talked about it for that matter. He talked about it because this is something that people had to understand. It was part of being alive. Anyhow, I want to read a few other things. This is that are somewhat more, I suppose we can say, practice oriented in a way. Oh, gotta get the right book here. So this is Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And this is directly related to, this idea of having a sense of a separate self. Because when we have a sense of a separate self, then when that self is dying, oh my God, what's going on? How can, anyhow, he's talking about how in this first one, actually, I think I read it this section a couple of weeks ago, but it's on my mind and it seems appropriate. He's talking about how we cling to our sense of a separate self, how we cling to the idea that somehow this body isn't going to die. Everyone else, yep, they're all going to go, but not me, boy. I'm not we get caught in that belief, right? The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in a self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves around it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. This includes this idea that's very prevalent that, well, everybody else is dying, but not me. We're clinging to this sense of a separate self so strongly that we can't think about, we don't want to look at that possibility that this might end. The self, me, Barry, is going to be gone someday. But the truth is, when this body stops working, which is called death, right? When it really stops working completely, Barry's gone. Gone. This personality called Barry is going to be gone. Because if you accept the teachings on not self, how could this not self, which isn't really Barry, because there is no Barry, because Barry's just a delusive idea that there's something separate that exists separately, how could that go on when there's no body to support it anymore? So what happens is part of the reason we cling to this sense of self is that we don't want to die. I don't want to die. No siree, boy. And that's that clinging to that sense of self is so strong because we see in our rational moments that sure enough, this body is gone. It's going to just be gone. And with it is anything this person called Barry isn't going to be around anymore. It just isn't going to be. Because this is just as impermanent as anything else. It's just as impermanent as anything else. And that Barry person is just an impermanent idea that's arisen and it hangs around for a while and people relate to it and then it's going to be gone. We don't like to think of this either. We sometimes think, well, my soul will go on or something like that. Nah, sorry. My friend and teacher Guy Armstrong explained this really beautifully to me once. He said, and this was his language that I found acceptable. I'm still not sure. I don't know it clearly, but it certainly made sense to me. He said that this body is attached to, in some way, connected to what we'll call a bundle of karmic energy. And as I act in the world, I am enhancing or detracting from that bundle of karma, and I'm either improving it or not. And as I improve it, then when that bundle of karmic energy takes a new body, which has nothing to do with Barry, there's like Barry doesn't reincarnate, Barry doesn't come back. That energy that I put into creating this bundle of karmic energy being greater, that's what re is still around. And eventually, through many, many lifetimes, that bundle of karmic energy gets so pure that it becomes enlightened. That the body, the person, associated with that bundle of karmic energy becomes an enlightened being, which of course changes the world. And then when that body dies, that bundle of karmic energy is done. It's just another impermanent arising that happened to have stuck around for millennia, but it's just another impermanent arising, and it's going to be gone too. Nothing left. It's just an interesting way to think about the whole idea of death and reincarnation and that process that we don't often, when we think of reincarnation, it's like, oh, well, I'm going to come back. No, that I you think you are is not going to come back. That isn't who's coming. This is, doesn't isn't going to happen. Sorry. We want it to, but it isn't. Anyhow, sort of a little curve away from what I thought I was going to say, but I thought I'd talk about that while I had the chance. So here's another little section. This is Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about craving. Craving, which is, the cause of suffering. Craving is what we have to overcome to become enlightened, right? The second noble truth, essentially. And that's what he's actually talking about, the second noble truth in this section of the book. And he's talking about a particular kind of craving. The second kind of craving the Buddha spoke of goes even deeper than the craving for sense pleasures. It's called the craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is a very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of the craving for becoming. The craving for becoming. It's like I want to, I'm in imagining my future self, I'm imagining that somehow I'm actually going to be still around at that point. Really, I mean, that's what we're thinking. Oh, yeah, next year when I go, da da da. And that's called craving for becoming. It's like we think that that future is going to exist. And sometimes we that the thought of that future existing is what keeps us going. Or makes us happy that I'm going to be happy in the future. Right now, things aren't so great, but I'm going to be happy in the future. Now, the only time you can be happy is right now. But if you're craving for becoming, you're always putting happiness sometime out there in the mysterious future, as opposed to just living in this moment and realizing that all the joy and happiness we need is right here, right now. Okay. Ah, yeah. Here's one other little piece of this is an interesting thing. This is actually straight from the Satipatthana Sutta. So the Satipatthana Sutta is the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. And in the first section, the first foundation of mindfulness of the four is mindfulness of body. Right, and we're used to thinking of that as like paying attention to our breath and our body sensations. And here's another part of the instructions that doesn't often get read, I don't think, let alone practiced. But it's an interesting one. Again, bhikkhus, as though we were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, which is basically often in India, there would be a space outside the village where they would literally just, someone died, and they weren't rich enough to get burnt. They would just take the body and throw it into this charnel ground. That's it would sort of just over time disappear. It was a space where bodies went. Okay. Again, because as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be that. It is not exempt from that fate. In this way he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, or both internally and externally. He abides independent. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews. He goes on quickly. A fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews. A skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone. A bhikkhu compares the same body to his that this is the body too is of this nature. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, the bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. This is the nature of bodies. This is where all bodies end up. Now we try in our current culture, you know, through embalming and things like that to somehow, you know, make this not seem like this doesn't really happen. You know, you go, I remember very distinctly going to my father's funeral because my father was really wanted to sort of go through this whole process. And one of my nieces like freaked out because there he was lying there in his coffin looking very sort of serene because there are people who work in that industry are very good cosmeticians. And she just like couldn't deal with the fact that he looked that way, but he wasn't there. There was no one there. There was just this prettied up body that made it look like things, he was going to always be that way. Sorry, this takes a little longer with embalming, but it's exactly the same thing is going to happen. And it's just something, once again, that we don't spend much time thinking about or anything. It's just like, oh, who wants to think about that? You know, that's what happens to bodies. But that's what happens to bodies. It's the natural. And the Buddha is saying, this is something you actually want to contemplate. This is something you want to be aware of and contemplate. It's a mindfulness instruction. I used to teach a lot of yoga once upon a time, and one of my teachers encouraged us and actually took us to labs where they were doing, you know, taking apart bodies and teaching anatomy school sort of things. And it was like shocking. The very first time, remember the first time I went, I was like, oh my God. You know, because, you know, they'd be there and they'd sort of very carefully peel back some skin off someone's chest, this body, because it wasn't someone, it was just a body. And you'd see that it's just like these muscles were there that looked like, you know, if you cut them the right way and wrap them in cellophane, they would look like something you'd buy in the grocery store. You know, this is what a corpse is. It's just, That's all it is. As the Buddha describes it, kind of graphically, but that's what you see. So it was interesting for me to do that because I actually went two or three times over a period of years, because it's like you really see that the body's just a bunch of stuff that's tied together somehow that functions until it doesn't. It's basically the nature of the body, right? But we don't want to deal with it that way. And though this is changing our culture, it used to be that most people, a huge number of people got buried in the way my father was 20 odd years ago, getting embalmed and now apparently it's like 80% of people get cremated. So that custom is disappearing, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a fine thing. But in a sense, that's like a different way to avoid the problem, because now there's no body there. It's just a bunch of ash. Well, we don't see the body rotting. Well, yeah, except if you hung out and watched it in the fire, you'd see it disappear just right before your eyes. Anyhow, what about the Buddha dying? What was that about? One of the last times the Buddha was teaching, just before he thought the Sangha was all gathered together, and they were basically saying, how could they possibly continue without him? How could they continue practicing without the teacher? And the Buddha basically said in another place that I'm not going to quote from, that this body's over 80 years old and it's not working so well anymore. I mean, essentially those words, this body isn't going to last much longer. And this is when then all of the bhikkhus were freaking out, going, oh my God. And this is what he said: therefore, be lamps unto yourselves, be a refuge to yourselves, hold fast to truth as a lamp. Hold fast to truth as a refuge. Look not for refuge in anyone besides yourselves. You all have to do this yourself. He's going back to the original, one of the original teachings. I mean, Sangha is powerful, and without Sangha it's very difficult, but in the end, this is something we all have to do ourselves. We have to be lamps unto ourselves. And the image of a lamp, it occurs in many, many other spiritual traditions. This is not at all unique to Buddhism. I grew up in the Christian world, so there's the thing about not hiding your light under a bushel. Letting your light shine out into the world. When I went to Sunday school, we used to sing this little song, right? This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. And this was like how it was like the light is an image for knowledge, for growth, for where I can go to. Even the phrase the Buddha was enlightened. The word itself, enlightenment, comes from that same root. He's enlightened. And then here's a couple more thoughts. In some senses, this whole practice is preparing for us to die. To die in a way where we can be mindful to our last breath. That's the ideal. That somehow we can stay mindful all the way through. But we can only do that because, the actual process of dying is not particularly pleasant. The only way we can do that is if we're practicing now to gain the ability to stay equanimous in the midst of the body literally disintegrating. Because as someone dies, what happens I've done a lot of hospice work, so as someone dies, basically your basic parts of your body start shutting down. Basic organs start shutting down. Your five senses start shutting down. You're left at the end. Basically, there's this body that maybe is still hearing, because hearing is the last sense to go, and it's breathing. And that's all that's left. And then that goes. That's just the nature of death. It's like it all happens to everyone. But can I be mindful all the way through that process? Can I, at some level, be there? And this is practice essentially prepares us for that time. It's one of the reasons to. There's another reason you want to do a lot of practice so you can be mindful at the end of it all, right? A couple of other, here's a few more, more on more cheerful notes. This is once again from Joseph Goldstein's book. This is a section called Death and Loving Kindness. The image used Often used to describe the practice of insight is that of walking a tightrope. As we're walking the tightrope, it becomes clear that the one thing we must pay attention to is balance, maintaining perfect poise. While walking on the tightrope, different things come whizzing by us, different sights and sounds, emotions, ideas, realizations. If these are pleasant, the conditioned tendency of mind is to reach out, try to hold on to them. Try to make them stay. If the sights and sounds are unpleasant, the tendency of mind is to reach out in aversion, trying to push them away. In both cases, we reach out, and in the reaching, lose our balance and fall. Both the positive and negative reactions are equally dangerous. Anything at all, however glorious or terrifying, which causes us to lose the perfect balance of mind, makes us fall. So we work again and again to develop a mind which does not react with clinging or condemning, attachment or aversion to any of these objects. Developing a mind which clings to naught, to absolutely nothing whatever, just allowing it all to come and pass away. Non-attachment grows out of a deep insight into impermanence. On one level, this insight is recognizing the inevitability and imminence of death. In the Bhagavad Gita, the question is asked, of all the world's wonders, what is the most wonderful? The answer, that no man, though he sees others dying all around him, believes that he himself will die. Each of us has this, has deeply ingrained patterns which bear witness to everything we do. Often these are destructive habits like anger or self-pity, but in just the same way, we can learn to keep in mind the awareness of death and have it bear witness to all our actions. If we take death as our advisor, we live each moment with the power and fullness we would give to our last endeavor on earth. When we keep death at our fingertips, we become less involved, less compulsive about the satisfaction or gratification of various desires in the moment. When not so clouded by desire and fantasies, we're less inclined to hold on to things and more open to love and generosity. The awareness of death provides the space of clarity in which we can understand the process of who it is that we are and who it is that dies. Insight into impermanence on this level is the awareness of the transitory, temporal nature of all phenomena from moment to moment. In every moment of mind-body process, our entire universe is arising and passing away, dying and being reborn. Working on developing a mind that is silent and still, one that is unmoving in the face of such enormous change. The whole practice evolves organically from simply being aware of what's happening in the present moment without reacting. One meditation teacher in India has said that all we have to do is sit and know that you are sitting. This is one of Joseph's teachers that I've been influenced by, obviously. And the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. You'll clearly see the unfolding of the laws of nature, and then the Dharma truly becomes your own. During this organic evolution, born of balance and detachment, many beautiful and freeing qualities of mind begin to manifest. One of these qualities is love, metta, love for oneself in the sense of being allowing and not judging. Have a spaciousness and a lightness of mind, and a strong loving kindness towards others, not relating in terms of grasping or the need for attachment. So understanding death leads to that, to an open heart. It seems like, nah, how can that be true? Death is so horrible. But that's what he's talking about here. He's saying if we really truly understand, then it frees us to let our hearts just be open to the moment, because we're not trying to keep going. We're not grasping and trying to cling to existence anymore. We're just being open to what is, what's arising and falling away. I put a little note here. One of the first really spiritual books I wrote, and I actually had to go, I don't have a copy of this book anymore, but was by Stephen Levine, who was a student of Ram Dass's, and the book was called Who Dies? That was the title. This is like 1989. This was like a pretty radical thing back in at that time to even talk about this stuff. And he talked very openly about everything I've been talking about and much more. But of course, I can't find a copy of the book anymore. I'm sure if I went on to Amazon, I could probably hunt one down. I probably should, because it was, I remember at the time it was like really, I had a powerful effect on how I was thinking about things. That's just a random thought I wanted to mention, because so this has been a topic that's been on my mind for 35 years or so now. Then the Buddha's last words. I found this interesting. So this is the very last thing the Buddha said before he left his body. Indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you. It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence. All formations are going to dissolve, which means this body. Attain perfection through diligence. So keep practicing. How often do you see that in some Dharma teacher writing to you? I've experienced this many times, where the last thing they say, and I've actually developed this habit when I'm replying to people's notes, when they write notes to me, I often put at the very end, keep practicing, Barry. That's how I sign things these days. Because that's what we have to keep remembering. Just keep practicing. It's all we have to remember, really. Just keep practicing. Just keep starting again. Just practice, practice. That's all we can do. And finally, this is, I'm sure some of you have heard me read this poem before. This is from Mary Oliver's book of poems called Thirst. And it's the poem she wrote in the time right after her longtime partner had passed away. And she's talking about, essentially, in her own poetic way, what the Buddha was talking about. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief. It's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. That speaks very openly about the experience of a loved one passing, that I think is quite beautifully moving.